Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. I'm Max Scott, and today we are absolutely ready to conduct an exhaustive deep dive into the AWS Certified AI Practitioner exam prep material. We are going to really unpack the most critical knowledge nuggets for the AIF C01 certification,
yep,
providing the focused insight, you know, that you need to master this domain.
And I'm Lauren Sanchez, here to provide, well, the broader context and maybe connect some of those dots across these pretty complex domains. Our goal today is really to give you a structural shortcut,
right,
taking you hopefully far beyond just a simple checklist and more into the practical understanding you need, both for the exam and honestly for your career.
Our mission is to take this, let's face it, enormous stack of preparation materials and distill it down into fast, accurate, structured insights. This certification, it's one of the most highly thought after for a good reason.
Oh, absolutely.
And the data really reflects just how explosive this field is right now.
It truly does. I mean, you look at AWS, they continue to be the dominant cloud player globally. They're holding a massive 31% market share as of early 2024.
Yeah.
That foundational strength means, well, understanding their AI tooling isn't really optional anymore for practitioners. It's non-negotiable.
And what's fascinating is where their growth is actually coming from. AWS's overall revenue, it surged to, what was it, $27.5 billion in Q3 2024. That's nearly a 20% year-over-year jump.
Huge number.
And the engine really driving that acceleration, it's their AI segment. It's been growing at a triple-digit pace all through 2024. This isn't some peripheral tech anymore.
Not at all.
It is the core growth driver for the biggest cloud provider out there.
And this knowledge, it translates directly into earning potential. I mean, for mm-hmm. those of you aiming for those specialized roles, ML engineers, AI developers who master these skills, mm-hmm. you're looking at salary ranges from, say, $85,000 up to $120,000 annually. Mm. And if you move into management, maybe overseeing these complex deployments as a project manager, salaries can climb up to $130,000, sometimes even more.
And it's not just about getting one of those specific job titles anymore, is it? The sheer ubiquity of this stuff means, what, 88% of all workers across industries expect to be using AI in their daily tasks by 2028.
It's becoming fundamental.
So this deep dive isn't just prep for a certificate, it's really prep for the near future of work.
Exactly. We're going to cover all five domains required for the exam. But look, we have to set the expectation early. The current market, and therefore the exam, puts a heavy emphasis on generative AI.
Right. Makes sense.
We figure probably over half of your test material is going to focus intensely on this area, really spanning domains 2 and 3. So we'll devote significant time there. But first, we really need to solidify the foundational AWS concepts. Everything else kind of builds on that.
Okay, sounds like a plan. Let's unpack the essential building blocks of the cloud. That's domain one, because, I mean, you can't really deploy an AI model without understanding the environment it actually lives in. Let's start with the fundamental ways businesses choose to host their infrastructure. The three cloud models.
Okay, so first up is the public cloud. This is the one most people know, the multi-tenant model.
Mm-hmm.
It's the core of AWS, Azure, Google Cloud. The key idea is resource sharing.
Mm-hmm.
The provider, like AWS, builds and maintains this massive infrastructure, and then multiple customers or tenants share those resources.
Mm.
That pooling gives you economy of scale, which means, you know, lower costs and more elasticity than trying to maintain your own hardware.
Okay, so that's public. Then you have the private cloud. This gives an organization like total control, right? They own and operate the hardware, the infrastructure, often keeping it on-premise.
Exactly. Yeah. Total control. But the big drawback is the high operational expense. You're buying hardware, dealing with specialized maintenance, hiring the staff needed to manage it 24/7. It's costly.
Sure.
But AWS does enable connections here. Amazon Virtual Private Cloud, VPC, that's often used to set up secure network links so your AWS services can talk seamlessly with those on-prem resources.
Got it. And the third model?
Well, the practical reality for most big companies is the hybrid cloud. This model blends the public and private environments. It allows for data and applications to move between them.
Right, flexibility.
And often, this also includes multi-cloud. That just means an organization is intentionally using multiple public providers, maybe AWS for their AI stuff and Azure for, say, internal identity management.
Why would they do that?
Usually for maximum redundancy, you know, avoiding putting all their eggs in one basket and avoiding vendor lock-in.
Okay, that makes sense. So those are the models where it runs. Now, let's shift to how you, the listener, actually consume it. This brings us to the three main cloud service types, the as-a-service models we hear about.
Right, and the core idea, defining all of these is that you're essentially renting the service via subscription. You're not making that big capital expenditure of owning the equipment yourself.
Pay as you go, essentially.
Exactly. The bedrock here is IES, infrastructure as a service. This gives you the core building blocks, mm-hmm. virtual machines, think Amazon EC2, storage, networking. With IES, you, the customer, keep control over the operating system, the middleware, the applications.
So maximum flexibility.
Maximum flexibility, but also the highest management burden. If the OS kernel needs a patch, that's on your team.
Okay. So if IES is the raw resources, what comes next?
Next is PaaS, platform as a service. This bundles up IES plus the necessary development environment and middleware. Think of tools like AWS Elastic Beanstalk or maybe SageMaker Jumpstart in the AI world. Here, the provider manages the underlying infrastructure and the middleware. It frees you up to focus just on your application code and your data. It really cuts down the management overhead, offers moderate flexibility.
Less to worry about. And the final one.
And finally, SaaS, software as a service. This is just a ready-to-use application managed entirely by the provider. You just log in and use it.
Like email or Office software online.
Exactly. Examples on AWS could be Amazon WorkDocs for document storage, or even Amazon Q, the generative assistant. Customization is usually minimal, but your operational burden is basically zero. It's purely consumption.
This distinction feels really critical for the exam, especially thinking about deploying AI.
Yeah.
Can we walk through the difference in effort between, say, using an IaaS approach versus a PaaS approach for getting a model running for inference?
Oh, it's a night and day difference. It's like being a mechanic versus just being a driver. If you go the IaaS route with Amazon EC2, your team is doing everything.
Everything, meaning?
Meaning spinning up the instances, picking the right Amazon machine image, installing Python, getting the right ML libraries like PyTorch or TensorFlow, configuring security groups, setting up API endpoints for the model inference, load balancing the traffic.
Oh, okay.
And then committing resources to ongoing patching and maintenance.
Yeah.
That level of control might be needed for some really custom or older systems, but boy, it eats up a lot of engineering time.
Right. So if I'm trying to optimize for business agility, getting something out the door fast, I definitely push for the PaaS approach, using something like SageMaker Jumpstart, for example.
Exactly. With Jumpstart, you basically select a pre-trained model, define your endpoints, and then integrate it with your application using simple API calls. You don't care about the OS kernel version. You don't care about the load balancer config.
You just care that the model works.
Precisely. That shift away from managing infrastructure to focusing purely on the application logic, that's the core business advantage of PaaS in the AI space. Speed.
And that speed ties into ML loops, which I know we'll get to. But first, how does AWS actually organize all these services around the world? Let's talk about regions.
Right, global footprint. AWS operates in isolated regions, things like US East 1 in North Virginia or U Central 1 in Frankfurt. Each region is physically and logically separate. That's key for stability.
So when you, the learner, are designing a solution, picking the right region is super important. Why specifically?
Three main reasons. First, proximity to your users. Closer means lower latency, faster speeds. Mm-hmm. Second, cost. Pricing can actually vary slightly between regions.
Good to know.
And third, maybe most critical sometimes, compliance. You have to meet specific local data residency rules like GDPR in Europe. Your data might have to stay within certain geographic boundaries.
Okay. And within each region, how do they ensure things stay up?
That's where availability zones, AZs, come in. Think of these as isolated data centers within a region, providing fault tolerance. Systems need to leverage these for high availability, meaning minimal downtime.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Amazon RDS, the database service. You can run it in a multi-AZ configuration. It automatically replicates your data to a standby instance in a different AZ within the same region. If the primary AZ goes down, failover is automatic and quick. Your database stays available.
Very cool. And this global footprint, it's not just regions and AZs, right? There are edge locations too.
Yes. Edge locations enhance the global footprint. While regions host the core services, specialized services like Amazon CloudFront, that's their content delivery network, or CDN use edge locations. These are like mini data centers, much closer geographically to your end users.
Why is that important for, say, an AI application? Lower latency again.
Absolutely. Latency matters hugely for user experience.
Yeah.
If you're serving up maybe dynamic product recommendations from an AI model on an e-commerce site or streaming video, delivering that content from an edge location near the user instead of going all the way back to the main region drastically cuts latency.
Makes pages load faster, makes apps feel snappier.
Exactly. It's pretty much essential for any high traffic or media heavy application today.
Okay, fundamentals covered. Before we jump fully into the ML lifecycle, we absolutely have to touch on the bedrock of security. AWS Identity and Access Management, or IAM, this controls who can do what in your cloud environment.
And the absolute foundational principle guiding IAM, especially when you've got sensitive data and powerful compute resources floating around, is the principle of least privilege.
Meaning?
Meaning every single IAM entity, whether that's a person logging in, an application making API calls, or a service role assumed by EC2, should only be granted the absolute minimum set of permissions required to perform its specific task. Nothing more.
So if a small script only needs to read from an S3 bucket,
it should not have permission to delete EC2 instances or change security groups. Sticking strictly to this principle drastically limits the potential damage if something goes wrong, like credentials getting compromised.
Makes perfect sense. Okay, let's move now into the core of the subject. The machine learning pipeline and fundamentals. This really spans across domains 1 and 2. And we don't start with data, surprisingly, but with a question. Is ML even the right tool for the job? That's ML problem framing.
Yes. And this is the step people often rush through, unfortunately. You need to translate a broad business goal, like improve customer satisfaction, into a specific measurable ML task. Maybe something like predict customer churn probability within the next 30 days.
But it's also about asking if ML is needed at all.
Right. Absolutely critical. If you can solve the problem with a straightforward, deterministic, rule-based, system-like calculating shipping costs based on package weight and destination zone, then traditional programming is almost always going to be faster, cheaper, and way easier to debug than building an entire ML system.
And the challenge gets even trickier when transparency is a must-have.
Exactly. If your organization operates in a regulated space, like finance making loan decisions, or maybe high-consequence healthcare diagnostics, anywhere you need fully auditable, explainable logic, many deep learning models, frankly, struggle to provide that clear why.
So in those cases?
In those cases, if a simple rules engine can get you, say, 90% accuracy and is fully transparent, it's often preferred over a complex black box model that gets 95% accuracy but can't clearly explain its reasoning.
Okay, so let's assume ML is the right fit. We move into the life cycle, starting with data collection and integration. High quality centralized data is basically the oxygen for any ML system.
Couldn't agree more. AWS offers a bunch of services here. Amazon S3 is the big one for centralized, super durable, scalable object storage. It's the default data lake for most ML projects because it's virtually unlimited and replicated across AZs.
You also mentioned EBS.
Right. Amazon EBS provides block storage that gets attached directly to your EC2 instances, good for faster access needed during maybe intensive training. And then there's Amazon Redshift for more traditional structured data warehousing.
Got it. So data's collected. Next comes the phase every data scientist knows well. Data pre-processing. This is the cleanup work.
Yep. Cleaning up the raw material, handling missing values, correcting errors, dealing with outliers.
Yeah.
It's a huge time sink. Historically, data scientists often spent close to half their time just wrangling data.
Wow, 45% or so. That's massive.
It is. And that's precisely why tools like SageMaker Data Wrangler or AWS Glue Data Brew are so valuable. They offer visual interfaces, pre-built transformations, trying to streamline this messy process.
So they can spend less time cleaning and more time on?
More time on feature engineering. This is where the art and the science really meet. You're transforming that raw, cleaned data into inputs features that maximize the model's ability to learn and make accurate predictions.
It's about finding what really matters in the data.
Exactly. It's figuring out which aspects of the data actually drive the prediction. Like in a house price model, square footage is a raw feature. But maybe price per square foot in that specific neighborhood is the engineered feature that the model truly leverages for accuracy.
Okay, data prepped, features engineered. Now we look at the core ML types. Let's start with supervised learning. This relies entirely on labeled data, right?
Correct. Labeled data is the key. Supervised learning breaks down into two main flavors. First is regression.
Regression is for predicting a number.
Yep, predicting a continuous numerical value. Think predicting tomorrow's exact temperature or the future market value of a stock.
And the other flavor?
Classification. Here, you're predicting a category or a class label. Is this image a cat or a dog? Is this bank transaction fraudulent or legitimate? The model learns from input features and their known correct labels.
Okay. So supervised needs labels. What about when you don't have labels?
That's unsupervised learning. It deals with unlabeled data. The model's goal isn't to predict a specific known outcome, but rather to discover inherent structures, hidden patterns, relationships within the data itself.
What are the main techniques there?
The primary one is clustering. This involves grouping similar data points together based on their features. A classic business use case is customer segmentation.
Ah, finding groups of similar customers.
Exactly. The model groups customers based on, say, purchasing behavior without any prior knowledge of those segments.
Right.
This allows for really targeted marketing campaigns. Another key technique is dimensionality reduction.
Reducing dimensions, simplifying the data.
Pretty much. It simplifies the data set by reducing the number of input features, but tries to do it while retaining most of the critical information. This can make model training faster and less prone to issues like the curse of dimensionality, where too many features cause problems.
Interesting. And the third main type of ML?
That's the fascinating one. Reinforcement learning, RL. Yeah. This is a totally different paradigm. It's a dynamic process where an agent learns through continuous trial and error interaction with an environment.
How does it learn?
It receives positive feedback or rewards for desirable actions and negative feedback or penalties for undesirable ones. Think of training an AI to play a really complex video game or maybe fly a drone in tricky conditions.
So it learns optimal strategies just by doing?
Entirely by trial and error, iterating based on that reward system. It's less common in standard business apps compared to supervised learning, but it's absolutely critical for complex control systems, robotics, optimization problems.
Okay, core types covered. Now, on to model development. Actually, training, evaluating, and tuning these models. When we train, we hit this concept of model fit. We need to find a balance, right, between two big problems.
Exactly. Two major failure modes, overfitting and underfitting. Let's start with underfitting.
Underfitting sounds like it didn't learn enough.
That's a good way to put it. The model is too simplistic. It hasn't captured the underlying patterns or relationships in the data. Maybe we didn't train it long enough. Maybe the features weren't good enough. Maybe the model architecture itself was too simple. It performs poorly on both the data it trained on and new unseen data.
Okay. And the opposite danger.
Overfitting. Here, the model is too complex. It's essentially memorized the training data, including all the noise, the specific quirks, the random errors present in that particular data set.
So it does great on the training data.
Fantastic performance on the training data. But then it fails miserably when you show it new unseen data because it hasn't learned the general underlying patterns. It just learned the specifics of the training set. Think of a spam filter that's overfit. Maybe it flags every email containing the word free, because that happened a lot in this training data, even legitimate ones.
Right. It didn't generalize. How do we fight overfitting?
Several key strategies practitioners use. You can try reducing the complexity of the model itself. Maybe use fewer features. You can significantly increase the size and diversity of your training data. Or you can use regularization techniques. L1 and L2 are the common ones.
Ah, regularization. For someone studying for the exam, what's the key practical difference between L1 and L2?
Great question. Definitely testable. Both L1, which is called lasso, and L2, called ridge, work by adding a penalty term to the model's loss function. This discourages the model from learning excessively large weights, which often contribute to overfitting.
Okay, so they both penalize large weights. How do they differ?
The key difference is how they penalize. L2 regularization shrinks all the weights uniformly towards zero, making them smaller, but they usually remain non-zero. L1, however, has a tendency to push some of the weights completely to zero.
Completely to zero, so it effectively removes features.
Exactly. L1 performs a kind of automatic feature selection.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a situation where you suspect many input features are irrelevant and you want the model to help you figure out which ones to drop, L1 regularization can be a really useful tool.
That's a super helpful distinction. Okay, model's trained, hopefully not too overfit or underfit. Now we need to evaluate it. Evaluation is essential. For classification tasks, you mentioned the confusion matrix.
Yes, the confusion matrix is the foundation. It breaks down predictions into four categories.
Mm-hmm.
True positives, correctly predicted positive. False positive, incorrectly predicted positive, a false alarm. True negatives, correctly predicted negatives. And false negatives, incorrectly predicted negative, a miss.
Right. And from these four numbers, we calculate the actual metrics. Accuracy seems straightforward, just the percentage of correct predictions overall.
It is straightforward, but accuracy can be really misleading, especially if your data is highly imbalanced. Imagine a fraud detection model where only 0.1% of transactions are actually fraudulent. A model that predicts nothing is fraud would be 99.9% accurate.
Yeah, that's not helpful at all.
Not helpful at all. Which is why precision and recall become so vital. Let's use two different examples to make it clear. Precision is all about minimizing false positives.
False positives. Predicting something is there when it isn't.
Right. Think back to that email spam filter. If it has low precision, it flags lots of legitimate emails, negatives, as spam positives, false alarms. So for spam filters, or maybe recommending irrelevant products, you want high precision. You want the things it flags as positive to actually be positive.
Okay, and recall.
Recall focuses on the opposite, minimizing false negatives. These are the misses cases where the model failed to detect something that was actually there.
Failing to detect something positive.
Think about a medical diagnostic system screening for a dangerous but rare disease. Missing an actual case, a false negative, could be catastrophic. Or maybe a security system failing to detect an actual intrusion. In these critical scenarios, you prioritize maximizing recall. You want to find as many of the actual positive cases as possible, even if it means generating a few more false alarms along the way.
So there's often a trade-off between precision and recall.
Absolutely. Improving one often hurts the other. That's why we often use the F1 score. It's the harmonic mean of precision and recall, providing a single metric that tries to balance both.
And the last metric you mentioned, AUC-ROC.
Right, the area under the receiver operating characteristic curve, or AUC-ROC. It evaluates the model's ability to distinguish between the positive and negative classes across all possible classification thresholds. A higher AUC generally indicates a better performing model overall in terms of discrimination ability.
Okay, that covers evaluation. Let's connect this whole pipeline back to practice through MLOps, machine learning operations. You hear it described as DevOps for ML, but if it's just software development and IT practices, why do we need entirely separate tools and concepts like SageMaker?
That's a fair question. While it borrows heavily from DevOps principles like automation and collaboration, MLOps introduces, I'd say, three unique and significant challenges that standard DevOps doesn't really handle.
Okay, what are they?
First, ML systems have this inherently experimental nature. You might iterate through hundreds, even thousands of model variations during development, tracking those experiments, their parameters, their results. That's complex.
Much more experimental than typical software build.
Exactly. Second, ML systems have a heavy reliance on large data sets that are often completely external to the code base itself. This means the system needs continuous monitoring, not just for code bugs, but for data drift.
Data drift, what's that?
Data drift is when the statistical properties of the data the model sees in production start to change over time, diverging from the data it was trained on. Maybe customer behavior changes, maybe a sensor starts degrading. If the input data drifts too far, the model's performance can silently degrade. MLOps needs to catch that.
Okay, experiments, data drift. What's the third?
The third is the need for continuous monitoring of the model itself. Its predictive performance can also decay over time, even if the data hasn't drifted much. So MLOps requires repeatable processes, not just for code deployment, but for model retraining, testing, validation, and redeployment.
So the key advantage of adopting a proper MLOps framework using automation tools like maybe SageMaker pipelines?
The key advantage is speed and repeatability. It translates directly to significantly faster time to market for new AI features and applications, and much quicker detection and recovery when models start to degrade in production. It makes the whole ML lifecycle manageable at scale.
Right, crucial for enterprise adoption. This brings us squarely to the examination's main focus area, the generative AI deep dive. This specialized subset of AI, it's defined by its ability to create totally new content, right? Text, images, video, even synthetic data.
Exactly. And the absolute foundation of this modern Gen AI revolution is the transformer architecture. It was introduced in that famous 2017 paper, Attention is All You Need.
And it solved a major problem with older models.
It really did. It solved the scaling problem that plagued previous sequential architectures, like recurrent neural networks, RNNs. RNNs processed information step by step, which made them struggle significantly with memory and maintaining context the longer the text sequence got. They had issues like the vanishing gradient problem.
So how did the transformer overcome that?
It achieved this breakthrough primarily through two core components. First, something called positional encoding. Since transformers process all parts of the input text simultaneously, not sequentially, positional encoding adds information about the position or order of words in the sequence.
Okay, so it still knows word order. And the second, more famous part?
The second and most critical innovation is the self-attention mechanism. This is the real heart of it.
Self-attention? How does that work conceptually?
Think of self-attention like a really focused researcher reading a long, complex document. As the researcher reads a specific word or concept, they constantly look back and forth, highlighting and noting how it relates to other important words or concepts earlier or later in the text.
Okay.
The self-attention mechanism does something similar mathematically. When processing a single word or token, it calculates an attention score reflecting the importance or relevance of every other word in the input sequence to understanding that specific word in context. This allows the model to capture long-range dependencies and contextual relationships far, far better than older models could.
That makes sense. So how does the text actually get into this system? Through tokenization.
Precisely. Tokenization is the first step. The input text is broken down into smaller units called tokens. A token could be a whole word, sometimes part of a word, or even just punctuation. These tokens correspond to entries in the model's internal vocabulary, which can be huge. Maybe 30,000 to 100,000 unique tokens in large foundation models. The text becomes a sequence of numbers.
And the number of tokens matters, right? There's a limit.
Absolutely. The token count is a hard boundary that determines the inference capacity, or, more commonly, the context window of the model. Longer input sequences, meaning very complex prompts, long documents you want summarized, or extended conversations demand significantly more memory and computational power during inference.
And if you exceed that limit?
Eventually, you exhaust the model's maximum context window. If your conversation goes beyond, say, 4,000 or 8,000 tokens, depending on the model effectively starts forgetting the beginning of the conversation when generating the next response. It loses that earlier context.
A key limitation to keep in mind. Okay, transformer is key. What other generative architectures are important to know? You mentioned GANs.
Yes, generative adversarial networks, GNs. These are fascinating systems. They consist of two neural networks that compete against each other. You have the generator, which tries to create new content, like images of faces. And you have the discriminator, which acts like an art critic or a detective, trying to determine if the content it's seeing is real, from the training data, or fake, created by the generator.
So they battle it out.
Exactly. That adversarial competition forces the generator to get progressively better at creating more and more realistic content to fool the discriminator. GANs have been incredibly successful at generating hyper-realistic images, like those lifelike but completely synthetic human faces you sometimes see, or even generating complex synthetic data for scientific simulations, like at CERN.
Wow. I heard a story, maybe you know it, that the idea for GANs actually came up during a discussion among researchers at a pub or a microbrewery.
That's the legend, Ian Goodfellow and colleagues. It's a great reminder, honestly, that sometimes the biggest breakthroughs don't happen just slaving away in the lab. They can come from those informal collaborations, those moments of just talking things through.
Absolutely. Keeps things in perspective. Okay, so transformers, GNs. Yeah. What's a third architecture? VAEs.
Right. Variational autoencoders, VAEs. These also use an encoder-decoder structure, kind of like GNs have a generator-discriminator. The encoder compresses the input data into a compact representation, but instead of just a single point, it creates a probability distribution in what's called a latent space.
A probability distribution, so like a map of possibilities.
Exactly. It captures the underlying variations in the original data. The decoder can then sample points from this latent space to generate new, plausible variations of the input data.
What are VAEs good for?
They're really useful for tasks like anomaly detection. Data points that don't map well onto the learned latent space distribution are likely anomalies. They're also used in creative fields, like product design. You could train a VAE on car designs, then sample from its latent space to generate novel but realistic new car variations.
Very cool. So these powerful architectures, they all lead up to the concept of foundation models, FMs, right? These are the huge ones we hear about.
Precisely. FMs are the backbone of much of modern Gen AI. These are large-scale, versatile, pre-trained models. Think models like OpenAI's GPT series, Google's PaLM or Gemini, Anthropic's Claude. We're talking models with hundreds of billions, sometimes even trillions of parameters trained on absolutely massive, diverse data sets, often terabytes of text and code from the internet.
And the key advantage is their adaptability.
Adaptability is the perfect word. Because they're pre-trained on such broad, generalized knowledge, a single FM can often perform reasonably well across a wide range of tasks right out of the box. Summarization, translation, question answering, code generation, creative writing, and more.
So businesses don't need a separate model for every little task.
Exactly. They can potentially rely on fewer, more powerful generalist FMs rather than building and maintaining dozens of narrow specialized models. That's a huge potential saving in effort and cost.
Okay, FMs are powerful, but they have a big limitation. They aren't trained on my company's specific internal proprietary data.
Correct. That's the critical gap. If you want the model to answer detailed questions based on your internal legal contracts or follow your company's specific customer service protocols, the base FM simply won't know how. This means we need to optimize or customize the FM, which generally involves two main approaches, fine-tuning and error.
Let's start with fine-tuning. What does that involve?
Fine-tuning involves taking a pre-trained FM and continuing the training process, but this time using a smaller, curated data set of specific labeled examples relevant to your domain, like maybe a data set of internal customer support chat logs paired with ideal responses.
So you're adjusting the model's internal weights.
Exactly. You're nudging the model's parameters so that its behavior, its knowledge, its tone aligns better with your specific organizational needs or domain knowledge. But performing a full fine-tune on all the parameters of a massive FM can be incredibly computationally expensive and time-consuming.
Which leads to
the increasing popularity and importance, especially for the exam, of parameter-efficient fine-tuning, PEFT, techniques.
PEFT sounds like doing less work.
In a way, yes. PEFT methods dramatically reduce the cost and compute time by updating only a small, specific subset of the model's parameters, or by adding small, trainable adapter modules rather than retraining the entire massive core of the model. This makes high-quality customization much more accessible and practical for many organizations.
Okay, so fine-tuning adapts the model itself. What's the other approach?
Ragu. Right. The second and arguably even more popular approach right now, especially for incorporating up-to-date or rapidly changing knowledge, is retrieval augmented generation, or RAON.
Retrieval augmented, so it retrieves information. Exactly. RAG enhances the FM's responses by dynamically retrieving relevant information from an external authoritative knowledge base at the time of the query, and then uses that retrieved information to help generate the final response. Crucially, it does this without needing to retrain or modify the underlying FM's parameters.
How does that actually work? What's the process? This seems really important for the exam.
It is vital. The RAG process usually starts with your knowledge base. This could be internal company documents, product manuals, recent news articles, whatever relevant information you need. This data needs to be prepared.
How?
It's typically chunked into smaller pieces and then converted into numerical vector representations using an embedding model. These dense vectors capture the semantic meaning of the text chunks. These vectors are then stored and indexed in a specialized vector database. Services like Amazon OpenSearch Service with its KNN capabilities or dedicated vector databases are often used here.
Okay, knowledge bases vectorized and stored. Then a user asks the question. Right. When you submit a user query, that query is also converted into an embedding vector using the same embedding model. The system then performs a semantic search, essentially. It compares the query vector to the vectors in the knowledge library stored in the vector database.
Looking for the closest matches.
Exactly. It retrieves the most relevant text chunks whose vectors are closest, semantically, to the query vector. This retrieved text, which represents the authoritative external knowledge relevant to the query, is then combined with the original user prompt.
Creating a bigger, better prompt.
Precisely. It creates an augmented prompt that now includes both the user's original question and the relevant context retrieved from the knowledge base. This augmented prompt is then fed into the large language model, LLM.
And the LLM uses that extra context.
Yes. The LLM uses that retrieved information to generate a response that is hopefully much more accurate, relevant, and grounded in the facts contained within that external knowledge source. This is the primary way businesses today make FMs useful with their own private, up-to-date information without constant retraining.
That's a fantastic explanation of RAG. Super clear. Okay, so whether we're using a base FM, a fine-tuned one, or one augmented with RAG, we need ways to control the output when we actually ask it to generate something. Let's talk about inference parameters. The most common one seems to be temperature.
Temperature is fundamental. Think of it as the control knob for randomness or creativity in the output.
Higher temperature means more random.
Exactly. A higher temperature, maybe 0.8 or 0.9, makes the model more likely to explore less probable word choices. It increases the diversity and, you could say, creativity of the output. This can be useful for brainstorming, generating different creative text formats, or just getting more varied responses.
But there's a downside.
The big downside is that higher temperature also significantly increases the risk of the model generating nonsensical, irrelevant, or factually incorrect outputs, what we call hallucinations.
Okay, so lower temperature.
A lower temperature, maybe down towards 0.1 or 0.2, makes the model much more deterministic and focused. It strongly favors the highest probability word choices at each step. This makes it ideal for tasks where you need consistency, accuracy, and predictability.
Like what?
Like code generation, factual summarization, translation, or answering specific questions where you want the single most likely correct answer.
Got it. Temperature controls randomness. What about other controls, like top K and top P?
Right. These are sampling strategies that work alongside, or sometimes instead of temperature. Top K sampling is pretty simple. It restricts the model's choices at each step to only the K most probable next words.
So if K is 10.
If K 10, the model calculates the probabilities for all possible next words in its vocabulary, sorts them, and then only considers the top 10 most likely words. It then picks the next word from only that restricted set, usually based on their probabilities. It prevents really low probability, often weird words from being chosen.
Okay. And top P, how is that different?
Top P, also called nucleus sampling, is a bit more dynamic. Instead of picking a fixed number K of words, it selects the smallest possible set of top words whose cumulative probability mass exceeds a certain threshold, P.
Cumulative probability. Can you give an example?
Sure. Let's say P is set to 0.9 or 90%. The model calculates the probabilities for the next words. Maybe the single most likely word has a 50% probability, the next most likely has 25%, the third has 10%. That adds up to 85%. The fourth most likely has 8%. Now we're at 93%. Since 93% exceeds the 90% threshold P, the model will only consider these top four words when choosing the next token.
Ah, so the number of words considered can change at each step, unlike top K.
Exactly. If the model is very certain about the next word, high probability for the top choice, top P might only consider one or two words. If the model is less certain, probabilities are more spread out, it might consider more words. It often results in a good balance between creativity and coherence, making it a very popular choice. These are definitely parameters you want to understand for controlling LLM output.
Definitely key levers to pull. But all this power, this generative capability, it introduces some serious risks we need to be aware of. The most famous one has to be hallucinations.
Yes, hallucinations are a major concern. This is when the FM generates responses that sound plausible, confident, and authoritative, but are actually false, misleading, or completely fabricated.
And this isn't like a bug, right? It's kind of inherent.
It's largely inherent to the probabilistic nature of how these models work. They're essentially predicting the most likely next word based on patterns, not accessing a knowledge database in the traditional sense, unless using Axing. Even with the biggest, most advanced FMs, studies show hallucination rates can still range anywhere from maybe 2.5% up to over 15% or even higher, depending on the task, the prompt, and the domain.
Which means you absolutely cannot blindly trust the output for critical applications.
Absolutely not. Critical content generated by LLMs must always be reviewed and verified by a human expert.
Okay, hallucinations. What's another related risk? Non-determinism.
Right, non-determinism. This trips people up who are used to traditional software. Unlike a standard program that gives the exact same output for the exact same input every time, FMs, especially with higher temperatures, might generate slightly different responses, even when given the identical prompt multiple times.
So that creativity can be a double-edged sword.
It can be. It means you need robust testing and evaluation pipelines within your MLOps workflow to ensure that these variations in output are still acceptable and safe within the context of your application's requirements and risk tolerance.
We also touched on the limited context window earlier. That's a risk too, right?
Definitely a practical limitation in risk. The maximum number of tokens the model can process at once. If your user engages in a very long conversation or you feed it a huge document, the model will eventually start forgetting the beginning of the context. This can lead to incoherent responses, loss of instructions, or just generally poor performance on long-running tasks. It's a design constraint you have to actively manage when building applications.
And the last big risk? Recency.
Recency, or the lack thereof. Foundation models are typically trained on a static snapshot of data up to a certain point in time. They have a knowledge cutoff date.
So they don't know about recent events.
Exactly. If a major world event happened yesterday or your company released a new product or policy last week, the base FM is simply unaware of it unless it's been very recently retrained, which is rare and costly, or unless you are actively feeding it that up-to-date information through a system like RH. Relying on a base FM for current information is a recipe for outdated or incorrect answers.
Okay, risks understood. Now let's move squarely into domain three, exploring the specific AWS AML services that bring all these concepts to life in the real world. Let's start with the main hub for generative AI on AWS, Amazon Bedrock.
Amazon Bedrock is absolutely central. You really need to understand the service for the AIFC Year 01 exam. It's a fully managed, serverless platform that gives you API access to a wide variety of foundation models.
From different providers.
Yes. Models from Amazon itself, like the Titan family, but also popular models from third-party providers like Anthropic, Claude, Cohere, Meta Llama, Stability AI, and others. The key benefit is that Bedrock abstracts away all the underlying infrastructure management. You don't worry about servers or scaling.
How do you choose which model to use?
You browse the model catalog within Bedrock. It acts like a curated library, providing detailed profiles for each available model, who made it, the version, release date, recommended use cases, supported modalities, text, image embeddings, pricing, etc. It helps you compare and select the best fit for your task.
And once you've picked a model, how do you actually run it or do inference?
You primarily have two options for managing inference capacity and cost. The default is on-demand inference. This is purely pay-per-use. You're billed based on the number of input tokens you send to the model and the number of output tokens it generates.
Good for getting started or for unpredictable workloads.
Exactly. Excellent for development, testing, or applications with low or sporadic traffic patterns. However, if you have a high-volume, production-critical application where consistent low latency is important,
you use the other option.
You'd likely choose provision throughput. With this, you reserve a specific amount of dedicated inference capacity for a particular model, usually measured in model units, for a set term, like 1 or 6 months.
Then the benefit.
The benefits are guaranteed throughput, consistently lower latency compared to on-demand, and often significantly lower costs if your usage volume is high and consistent enough to utilize that reserve capacity effectively. It requires more planning, but can be much more economical at scale.
Bedrock isn't just about accessing models, though. It also has this concept of agents, right? What do they do?
Right. Agents for Amazon Bedrock are really powerful. They provide a low-code, almost no-code way to build more sophisticated, autonomous agentic workflows on top of the FMs.
Autonomous meaning?
Meaning they can do more than just generate text. An agent can break down a complex user request into multiple steps. It can interact with proprietary knowledge bases, using RAG, which we discussed, to get specific information. And crucially, it can access external tools.
Tools like what?
Tools could be calling other AWS services via Lambda functions, making API calls to external systems like a booking system or a CRM, or executing database queries. This allows the agent to actually perform actions in the real world based on the user's requests, not just talk about them.
Wow. Okay. So you could build an agent to, say, check inventory and place an order.
Precisely. And this architecture also supports quite sophisticated multi-agent collaboration. You could design a workflow where different specialized agents work together.
Like a team.
Kind of. Imagine a customer service scenario. You might have an intents agent that first figures out what the customer actually wants. Then maybe a retrieval agent pulls the relevant policy documents from a knowledge base. Perhaps a sentiment analysis agent monitors the tone. And finally, a response generation agent takes all that input and crafts the final reply. Bedrock agents facilitate orchestrating these kinds of multi-step, multi-agent interactions.
That's pretty advanced stuff, moving beyond simple Q&A. Now, related to Bedrock, there's also Amazon Q. How does that fit in? Is it just another chatbot?
Amazon Q is related, as it's also a generative AI assistant, but is specifically focused on enterprise needs. Think of it as an AI assistant designed to integrate deeply and securely within a business environment, connecting to your company's data, code repositories, and business applications.
So it's not just for general knowledge. It has different versions.
Yes, it has a few key facets. For developers and IT professionals, there's Amazon Q Developer. This integrates directly into IDEs like VS Code, the AWS console, and even Slack.
What does it help developers do?
A lot, actually. It provides real-time code suggestions, like GitHub Copilot or Code Whisperer, which it enhances, helps with debugging code, can explain existing code bases, assists with upgrading application versions, can even help troubleshoot AWS issues or analyze potential cost optimizations in your architecture. Crucially, it leverages enterprise-grade security and access controls, understanding your IAM permissions.
Very useful for the technical folks. What about the business side?
For the business side, there's Amazon Q Business. This version connects securely to your enterprise data sources. Think wikis, intranets, document repositories, Salesforce, etc. And allows employees to ask natural language questions and get summarized answers, generate reports, or create content based on that internal information.
And it integrates with other tools.
Yes. For instance, within Amazon QuickSight, the business intelligence service, there's QuickSight Q. This lets users simply ask natural language questions about their data, like, what were our top 10 best-selling products in the UK last quarter? And QuickSight Q automatically generates a relevant visualization, like a bar chart or table. It makes data analysis much more accessible.
And it also helps in contact centers.
It does. Amazon Q can integrate with Amazon Connect, the cloud contact center service, providing features like real-time call transcription, automated conversation summaries for agents, and suggesting relevant knowledge articles to agents during calls to help resolve customer issues faster. So Q is really about bringing generative AI into the business workflow securely.
Okay, Bedrock and Q are the big Gen AI players, but the exam also covers a range of pre-trained AI services, right? These are more specialized, solving specific problems without needing model training from the user, still part of Domain 3.
Absolutely. These are crucial building blocks. First and foremost, while we talked about SageMaker Jumpstart for PaaS, Amazon SageMaker as a whole remains the central end-to-end platform for the entire traditional ML lifecycle.
So it covers everything.
Pretty much everything we discussed earlier in the ML pipeline. It has components like SageMaker Data Wrangler for visual data prep, SageMaker Feature Store for managing and sharing engineered features, automated hyperparameter tuning, SageMaker Experiments for tracking model runs, and SageMaker Model Monitor for detecting data and concept drift after deployment. If you're building custom models, SageMaker is your workbench.
Got it. What about natural language processing, NLP, if I just need to analyze text?
For pre-built NLP capabilities, you look at Amazon Comprehend. This service takes raw text as input and extracts various high-value insights without you needing to train any models.
Like what kind of insights?
Common use cases include sentiment analysis, determining if a piece of text, like a product review or a social media post, is positive, negative, neutral, or mixed. It can do entity recognition, identifying things like people, places, organizations, dates within the text. Key phrase extraction helps quickly identify the main topics being discussed.
That sounds useful for understanding customer feedback.
Definitely. And critically, Comprehend also performs PII detection, personally identifiable information. It can automatically identify and optionally redact sensitive data, like names, addresses, phone numbers, credit card numbers, social security numbers from text. This is vital for meeting privacy regulations like GDPR or ECPI before storing or processing text data.
Okay, Comprehend for text analysis. What if my input isn't neat text, but like a scanned document or a PDF invoice?
That's where Amazon Textract comes in. Textract is specifically designed for optical character recognition, OCR, but goes way beyond just extracting raw text. It understands the structure of documents. It can identify not just text, but also tables and forms within scanned images or PDFs. And it extracts this information in a structured format, typically JSON, preserving the table structure or the key value pairs from a form.
So it wouldn't just give me a wall of text from an invoice.
No. It would identify the vendor name, the invoice number, the line items in the table with their quantities and prices, the total amount, all as distinct structured fields. This is huge for automating document processing workflows, like accounts payable or processing loan applications, saving immense amounts of manual data entry.
Makes sense. What about searching through internal company documents? Is there a service for that?
Yes, for intelligent enterprise search, there's Amazon Kendra. Think of it as a superpowered search engine specifically for your internal content.
How is it different from just regular search?
Unlike traditional keyword search that just matches words, Kendra uses natural language understanding, NLU, to grasp the meaning and intent behind a user's query. You can ask a question in plain English like, what is the company policy for international travel expenses?
And it finds the answer.
It aims to return a precise answer snippet directly from the most relevant documents in your connected data sources, like SharePoint, Confluence, S3, databases, rather than just giving you a list of 10 documents that happen to contain the word travel. It significantly improves knowledge discovery and employee productivity.
Okay, Kendra for internal search. What about personalization for customer-facing apps, like recommending products?
For real-time personalization and recommendation engines, the service is Amazon Personalize. This is based on the same technology Amazon uses for its own e-commerce recommendations.
How does it work?
You feed it data about your users, your items, products, articles, videos, and importantly, the interactions between them, clicks, views, purchases. Personalize then uses sophisticated ML models to learn user preferences and item similarities.
And then it generates recommendations.
Yes, it provides real-time personalized recommendations for each user via an API. You can use it to power things like customers who bought this also bought, recommendations, personalized product rankings on a homepage, or tailored content suggestions in a media app. It's all about driving engagement and conversion.
Cool. What about building conversational interfaces like chatbots or voice assistants?
For that, you'd use Amazon Lex. Lex is a service for building conversational AI applications. It provides the core capabilities needed.
Which are?
It uses automatic speech recognition, ASR, to convert spoken language into text. Then it uses natural language understanding, NLU, to decipher the user's intent, what they're trying to achieve, versus book a flight, check account balance.
And it also needs the details, right?
Exactly. NLU also extracts the specific pieces of information needed to fulfill that intent, which are called slots. For booking a flight, the slots might be destination city, departure date, return date, number of passengers. Lex manages the dialogue flow to collect all the necessary slots before taking action. It's the engine behind many Alexa skills and customer service bots.
Okay, one more pre-trained service. What about detecting fraud? That seems like a classic AI use case.
Absolutely. For that, AWS offers Amazon Fraud Detector. This is a fully managed service specifically designed to help businesses identify potentially fraudulent online activities.
What kind of activities?
Common use cases include detecting suspicious online payment transactions, identifying potential account takeover attempts, like unusual login patterns, or spotting fake account registrations during customer signup.
How does it work? Do you need to be an ML expert?
Not necessarily. Fraud Detector uses machine learning models under the hood, leveraging Amazon's own experience with fraud detection. You provide your historical business event data, both legitimate and known fraudulent examples, select a pre-built model template, or customized one, and the service trains a tailored fraud detection model for you. You then send new events to the model via an API, and it returns a risk score and the reasoning behind it. It helps businesses catch more fraud faster, reducing losses.
That's a really comprehensive set of tools. Okay, this powerful toolkit naturally leads us into the final but absolutely critical domains for the exam. Domains 4 and 5. These focus on responsible AI, security, and governance. You can't just deploy these powerful tools without strong guardrails.
Couldn't agree more. Deploying AI responsibly is paramount. Responsible AI is an umbrella term ensuring that the systems we build are ethical, fair, transparent, accountable, and trustworthy. The first major pillar here is fairness and bias.
Bias is a huge concern, especially if AI is used for important decisions like hiring or loan applications.
It absolutely is. We need to ensure that AI systems do not perpetuate or even amplify existing societal biases, leading to unfair or discriminatory outcomes based on protected characteristics like gender, race, ethnicity, age, etc.
Where does bias come from?
Bias can creep in at multiple stages. There's data-level bias, where the data used to train the model is itself skewed, unrepresentative, or reflects historical discrimination. There's also model-level bias, which can be introduced by the choice of algorithm, the way features are engineered, or the optimization process itself.
How can AWS help address this?
A key tool here is SageMaker Clarify. Clarify provides capabilities to help data scientists and ML engineers detect potential statistical bias in datasets before training, and also to analyze bias in trained models after training, looking at how predictions might differ across different subgroups. It calculates various fairness metrics to help you identify and potentially mitigate these issues before deployment.
Okay, fairness is crucial. What's next under responsible AI? Intellectual property?
Yes, intellectual property, IP, is a rapidly evolving area, especially with generative AI. Since FMs are often trained on vast amounts of web data, which includes copyrighted material, there are significant legal and ethical questions around the ownership and use of AI-generated content.
We saw this with the Hollywood strikes, right?
Exactly. The 2023 Hollywood writers and actors strikes highlighted these concerns intensely. Key issues included ensuring human creators receive appropriate credit and compensation when AI is used to generate scripts or likenesses, and preventing AI from replacing human creative work without fair consideration. Responsible deployment requires clear policies on respecting copyright, adhering to licensing terms, and potentially implementing source citation, acknowledging the origins of training data where feasible.
Okay, IP is complex. What about transparency and explainability? Are they the same thing?
They're related, but distinct. And it's useful to understand the difference. Transparency generally refers to having insight into the overall system design. Knowing what data was used for training, understanding the model architecture, being aware of the system's limitations. It's about the what and how of the system as a whole.
And explainability.
Explainability, or interpretability, focuses more on understanding the reasoning behind specific individual predictions or decisions made by the model. Why did the model classify this particular loan application as high risk? Why did it generate this specific sentence?
Is explainability always easy to achieve?
Not always. There's often a trade-off. Simpler models, like linear regression or decision trees, tend to be more inherently interpretable, but might offer lower predictive performance on complex tasks. Highly complex models, like deep neural networks, often achieve state-of-the-art performance, but can be much harder to explain. They act more like black boxes. Choosing the right balance depends heavily on the application's context and risk.
And sometimes, even with the best models, they make mistakes or face ambiguous situations. That's where humans come in.
Exactly. We need human-in-the-loop, HITL, processes. AI should augment human capabilities, not necessarily replace them entirely, especially for sensitive or high-stakes tasks. AWS provides Amazon Augmented AI, A2i, to help with this.
What does A2i do?
A2i makes it easier to build workflows that integrate human review for AI predictions. You can set conditions, for example, if the model's confidence score for a prediction is below a certain threshold, or for specific types of sensitive content, A2i automatically routes that prediction to human reviewers for verification or correction. It can manage workflows using your own private workforce, third-party vendors, or even Amazon Mechanical Turk for large-scale tasks like content moderation or data labeling.
Okay, those are key responsible AI principles. Now let's shift specifically to security and governance for AI, especially GenAI. You mentioned new attack vectors earlier.
Yes, generative AI introduces some unique security vulnerabilities. The two most talked about are prompt injection and prompt leaking.
Prompt injection sounds nasty. What is it?
It is. This is where an attacker carefully crafts a malicious input prompt designed to manipulate the LLM, trying to bypass its safety guidelines or intended purpose. They might use tricky phrasing, often starting with instructions like, ignore all previous instructions and do this instead, to try and coax the model into generating harmful content, revealing sensitive information it shouldn't, or executing unintended actions if the LLM is connected to external tools.
So tricking the model through its input.
Essentially, yes. It's a major challenge because the attack surface is the natural language input itself.
And prompt leaking.
Prompt leaking is related. This is the risk that the model might inadvertently disclose its own internal system prompt, the confidential instructions or configurations that define its persona or task, or potentially even snippets of proprietary data it was fine-tuned on during a normal interaction with the user. This could reveal trade secrets or operational details.
How do we defend against these prompt-based attacks?
It requires a layered defense. Firstly, robust input validation and sanitization is crucial, trying to filter out or block known malicious patterns or instructions in user prompts before they even reach the LLM. Secondly, using platform-level safety features is key.
Like Bedrock guardrails.
Exactly. Amazon Bedrock Guardrails allows you to define and apply safety policies across your FM applications. You can configure denied topics to block conversations about specific harmful or inappropriate subjects. You can set up content filters based on thresholds for hate speech, insults, sexual content, etc. You can also define lists of specific sensitive words or phrases to block. These guardrails act as a safety net applied in real time to both prompts and responses.
So input filtering plus output monitoring. Okay, let's broaden the scope to overall cloud security and compliance. The shared responsibility model is always fundamental on AWS. How does it apply here?
It applies just the same, and it's absolutely critical to understand for the exam. The shared responsibility model clearly defines who is responsible for what aspects of security.
AWS is responsible for.
AWS is responsible for the security of the cloud. That means protecting the underlying infrastructure that runs all the AWS services. The physical security of the data centers, the hardware, the networking, and the security of the core managed services themselves, like the Bedrock platform infrastructure.
And the customer is responsible for?
The customer is responsible for security in the cloud. This includes everything you build and configure on top of AWS. That means your data, securing it, encrypting it, your applications, patching vulnerabilities, managing access controls, IAM policies, user permissions, configuring network security, security groups, VPCs, and ensuring your specific AI workloads meet compliance requirements. Ultimately, securing your generative AI application and data is your responsibility.
And speaking of compliance needs, Governance becomes really non-negotiable when dealing with regulated data or high-stakes decisions.
Absolutely. If your AI application processes protected health information, PHI, you need to ensure HIPAA compliance. If it handled data from EU citizens, GDPR applies. If it's making financial decisions like loan approvals or insurance underwriting, there are often specific regulatory requirements around fairness, transparency, and auditability. These high-consequence systems require rigorous oversight, documentation, and governance.
How does AWS help manage this compliance burden?
AWS provides several tools to help. AWS Audit Manager is a really important one. It helps you continuously audit your AWS usage to simplify how you assess risk and compliance with regulations and industry standards. It automates the collection of evidence needed for audits against frameworks like SOC2, APA, PCI-DSS, and others, significantly reducing the manual effort involved in preparing for and passing audits.
That sounds incredibly useful. What about tracking activity?
For complete accountability and security monitoring, AWS CloudTrail is essential. CloudTrail records virtually every single API call made within your AWS accounts. Who made the call, when, from where, what resources were accessed or changed. This detailed log trail is indispensable for forensic security investigations, troubleshooting operational issues, demonstrating compliance, and maintaining strict accountability over who is doing what in your environment.
Okay. And one final piece for trustworthy AI seems to be data lineage and documentation.
Yes. Building trust requires transparency about how models were built and how they should be used. This involves practices like creating model cards.
Model cards, like nutrition labels for models.
That's a great analogy. Model cards are documents that provide standardized information about an ML model. They typically describe the model's intended use cases, its performance characteristics on different data slices, fairness assessments, limitations, ethical considerations, and the data used for training. They help users understand if a model is appropriate for their specific task and context.
And source citation.
Source citation, particularly for generative AI, relates back to the IP discussion. It involves acknowledging the origins of the data used to train or fine-tune the model, including any relevant licenses or usage restrictions associated with that data. This transparency is key for building trustworthy systems and navigating the complex legal landscape.
Wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground, everything from the basic definition of AI coined way back in 1956, through the cloud fundamentals, IaaS versus PaaS, the entire ML pipeline from problem framing to MLOps.
The deep dive into Gen AI architectures like transformers and JANs, the critical difference between fine-tuning and RAG, controlling inference with parameters like temperature.
And then mapping all of that to specific AWS services like Bedrock, Amazon Q, SageMaker, Comprehend, Textract, Kendra, Personalize, Lex, Fraud Detector. And finally, wrapping up with the vital aspects of responsible AI, security guardrails like Bedrock guardrails, and core governance tools like Audit Manager and CloudTrail.
If you've absorbed this material, you have genuinely covered the major conceptual and technical domains required for the AWS Certified AI Practitioner Exam, AIF-C01.
Absolutely. It's a comprehensive overview.
And I think the most important implication for you, the learner listening to this, isn't just about passing an exam. It's about realizing the sheer scale of the technological and economic shift you're participating in. PwC estimates that AI could contribute up to $15.7 trillion to the global economy by 2030.
Trillion with a T, that's staggering.
It is. And that value is going to be captured and realized primarily by the individuals and organizations who truly master the kinds of tools and concepts we've discussed today.
It's clear the potential is enormous, but you know, even with the breakthroughs we've seen, like the transformer model, which was revolutionary, many experts suggest that reaching the next level, maybe something closer to artificial general intelligence, AGI, will likely require more than just scaling up current approaches.
That's a strong possibility. It might require moving beyond systems that are fundamentally prediction machines, perhaps needing entirely new architectures, or maybe leveraging fundamentally different computing paradigms, like the potential power of quantum computing down the road.
Which leads to a fascinating final thought for you to consider.
So here's our provocative question for you. If foundational innovations like the transformer architecture arguably emerged from that paper, and maybe GANs from a chat in a microbrewery, where will the next truly fundamental breakthrough in AI come from? The one that might change the underlying physics of how models learn or reason.
And perhaps more importantly for your career, when that breakthrough happens, maybe sooner than we think, how quickly will you be able to understand it, adapt to it, and integrate that fundamental change into your practice and your knowledge base? This field isn't just changing, it's defined by constant, accelerating change.
It's definitely a field that keeps you on your toes.
A great thought to chew on as you continue your learning journey. Thanks so much for joining us for this deep dive into the AWS Certified AI Practitioner Exam Prep. We genuinely wish you the very best of luck with your studies and the exam.